This is an ABC podcast.
Talo for lover and welcome to Pacific Beat. I'm Talia Olatia. When New Zealand went into stage 4 lockdown last week, they made sure that men who felt that they were going to harm a loved one or whānau member knew they had a service to reach out to. 0800 Hey Bro.
We all get angry. The best thing we can do is talk to somebody.
Don't hesitate. Don't be whakamā. Just pick up their phone.
This number is set up for men who feel they are going to harm a loved one or whānau member. We're here to support 24/7.
Now, Fiji already has a high level of domestic violence, and the head of the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre says those levels will only get higher if measures aren't put in place to help the vulnerable while in lockdown.
There could be mayhem in terms of, you know, perhaps people being traumatised, needing a lot more counselling. We might also be dealing with the suicidal cases.
And as some Pacific countries look to limit the spread of information about coronavirus, the Pacific Freedom Forum, which is the region's media rights organisation, is concerned about the lengths governments may go to and want them to respect press freedoms. The coordinator of the forum, Lisa Williams-Lahari, will join us live shortly. And also on Pacific Beat, you'll hear about ancient artefacts that have been uncovered in the highlands of what is now Papua New Guinea that shows a change in human behaviour from thousands and thousands of years ago.
What keep popping up in all these villages, all these really intriguing artefacts, some of the stone axes, pestles and mortars, club heads, and these really sort of enigmatic stone carvings of human and bird faces that we've seen on the surface but we've never found in the ground.
Those stories and a whole lot more coming up on Pacific Beat with me, Talia Olatia.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, the number of positive COVID-19 cases in the Pacific region remain fairly stable, with just a handful of new cases confirmed in Guam. But there are reports of another coronavirus-related death. Authorities in the small US territory of the Northern Mariana Islands, or CNMI, say a 70-year-old man died yesterday, but they're still waiting for the test results to confirm if he had COVID-19. They say the man had had contact with someone who already tested positive and had several underlying medical conditions. Here's the CNMI Governor, Ralph Torres.
And we never want to make this type of announcement. Lieutenant Governor Palacios, our families and I extend our deepest condolences to the patient's wife and family. We are deeply saddened by the passing of our community. Our thoughts are with the deceased family during this difficult time. I understand that the CNMI residents will be affected by this news.
CNMI, which has a population of just 55,000 people, confirmed its first two cases at the weekend. Nearby Guam, which has the region's highest rate so far and had the first COVID-19-related death last week, confirmed another two cases yesterday, bringing its total to 58, which is half of all cases in the Pacific. In Papua New Guinea, the Prime Minister James Marape has sent a clear message about the need for people to keep within its borders. James Marape switched between both English and Pidgin in his update yesterday. He did this to ensure that everyone across the country could understand.
For whatever reason, you like go along the Indonesia border, go on the other side. I'll be speaking with the President of Indonesia. I've also spoken with the Prime Minister of Australia, so our joint international borders will be given a step up protection on our side as well as on the other side. So Papua New Guineans, as your Prime Minister, I will be speaking without fear or favour. Any one of you want to cross to the other side, our government has made it illegal already. And if you're going on the other side, the police on the other side pick you up and lock you. Don't cry to our government asking for you to be bailed out there.
That was PNG Prime Minister James Marape there. He also revealed some of the economic rescue packages his government is considering, because Papua New Guinea is halfway through an initial 14-day state of emergency that's seen much of the country in lockdown. That is just a quick wrap of some of the coronavirus-related news happening in the region right now.
Coronavirus is a new virus with symptoms similar to flu. It can be dangerous for older people and people who are already unwell. Here are some things you can do to stop it from spreading. Regularly wash your hands with soap for at least 20 seconds. Avoid physical contact with others if possible. Don't touch your eyes, nose, or mouth. Cough or sneeze into your elbow. If you develop a fever or difficulty breathing, call your local hospital or health centre.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. Right around the world, there are fears about what lockdowns will mean for women who live in homes with an abuser. In the Pacific, women's groups in Fiji are bracing for a rise in the country's already high level of domestic violence as measures to contain the spread of coronavirus are stepped up. Around the world, there are reports of increased abuse of isolated women and children in areas that have been locked down or quarantined. The head of the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre says there could be, quote, mayhem if more help is not provided to the vulnerable. Liam Fox reports.
Domestic violence is already a huge problem in Fiji. An often quoted survey back in 2011 found nearly two-thirds of women had suffered physical and or sexual violence at the hands of their partners. There are fears the situation could get worse as stricter measures are put in place to stop the spread of coronavirus in the country.
That whole thing about social distancing, which creates social isolation, and that is where perpetrators thrive, you know, in what they do.
Shamima Ali is the coordinator of the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre. She says the centre is yet to see an increase in calls for help for domestic violence, but predicts it will come.
There could be mayhem in terms of, you know, perhaps people being traumatized, needing a lot more counseling. We might also be dealing with the suicidal cases.
Fiji has not seen the kind of strict social isolation put in place in other countries such as Italy and the United States, where people have been ordered not to leave their homes. Only one town has been locked down, Lautoka, where the first case was discovered. It's been cut off from the rest of the country and non-essential businesses closed, but residents can still move around. Nonetheless, the lockdown is putting a lot of pressure on women, according to local resident Benita Ngio.
These women are taking it to themselves. They do not have someone to talk to. They do not have a place to distress.
She says many women have lost their jobs in the tourism and garment industries. That's a double blow. The loss of income and the increased pressure it puts on the women's families. Ms. Ngio is the executive director of the Pacific Rainbows Advocacy Network, which represents female sex workers. She says they've been hit hard too.
Most of the members of the community are finding a problem to meet their needs because of the dropping clients. And with that, most of these women are not able to buy basic food items, goods like sanitary pads. And what's even worse for us here in Lautoka is that a part of our sex working community are homeless.
The Fiji government is aware of the potential for an increase in domestic violence. The Minister for Women and Children, Merasani Vuniwanga, has said the safety and security of women and girls is a top priority. She has said her ministry is working with other agencies and NGOs to ensure perpetrators do not use this situation as an opportunity to commit violence. Benita Ngio has an idea to help vulnerable women.
Maybe just a hygiene kit that could have extra pads, extra panties, towels. Also, secondly, if we could have some basic food items.
Shamima Ali says the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre's 24-hour phone line will continue to operate throughout the coronavirus crisis. She says the Salvation Army has opened shelters for vulnerable women and children, and she hopes police will provide transport for those who want to stay there. Ms. Ali says men should also be targeted in any new initiatives.
We're also appealing to men, to kindness, compassion, the Pacific culture. This is the time when we come together. So, you know, we are developing messages, very clear messages about, you know, basic humanity and kindness to each other.
That was Shamima Ali, coordinator of the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre, ending that report by Liam Fox.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
As governments around the world take drastic measures to stop coronavirus from spreading, some Pacific countries are looking to limit the spread of information about the disease too. Just yesterday, a Fiji opposition MP, Linda Tambuya, was let out on bail after being charged over Facebook posts she made relating to the virus. She's one of a number of people in Fiji who's been charged, accused of breaching the country's Public Order Act by allegedly sharing false or alarmist news about the pandemic. It comes as Vanuatu, as part of its state of emergency, has ruled that media outlets can only publish stories about COVID-19 if they get official authorisation. Although its government told Pacific Beat last week that this measure actually only applies to social media accounts that spread fake news. Nevertheless, the region's media rights organisation, the Pacific Freedom Forum, is concerned and this morning has issued a statement urging governments to respect press freedoms amidst the pandemic. Journalist and coordinator of the Pacific Freedom Forum is Lisa Williams-Lahari, and she joins me now. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Now, Lisa, what are your concerns and the Pacific Freedom Forum's concerns when it comes to government responses to the coronavirus and media freedom?
I guess the key concern for many journalists is not just being mindful of the ethics and the fact-checking, the new onus on the industry and newsrooms to ensure that the facts are right, the ethics are being applied and getting out there, but also that governments recognise the very special partnership role of the media and information-sharing conduit that they provide, and not abuse it to just treat it as a one-way channel for official announcements while shutting down responses on the tough questions that people are continuing to ask.
Do you feel that the governments might use this virus as a way to impose authoritarian measures?
Well, there is a fear that that is already happening. In the Cook Islands on Friday in Rarotonga, they passed legislation tagged as COVID-19 response, but a very big part in it focused on what they called misinformation or harmful information. And the restrictions of that legislation are such that any individual could go to jail for up to 12 months and have really harsh fines. Companies who breach the legislation, the information clause in it, can be charged up to $200,000. That's big money. That could pretty much drive a newsroom out of business. And so that kind of restrictive measure is already going to gag the existing media, or what you call freedoms, that are being applied and covering it with a diverse approach and ensuring that all the voices are heard, especially from Cook Islands families who are affected, not just in the Cook Islands but in New Zealand. And so I can see already it's going to be difficult to apply. It's going to be difficult for newsrooms to have that hanging over their heads on top of covering the pandemic. But it's also going to be difficult for governments who are trying to stay on top of the pandemic to apply.
But arguing for the case of the government, isn't there a need to regulate the media, particularly online, as a matter of public health to make sure that misinformation, or as the World Health Organization have called it, an infodemic, doesn't happen?
Misinformation and the infodemic does not necessarily have the best response in legislation that threatens. I think WHO itself would agree that the best response is to educate, to innovate, to get into the platforms where they see this happening, social media being the best example, and spread the word, spread the facts, and also educate people on how to ascertain what the facts are in those spaces. Mm. So those approaches that take a more innovative, open and I guess also open up to the idea that this is not a space that is just going to plug one agenda. You've got to be open to correcting what's out there is going to succeed in the long term. So I think that there are many opportunities that the platforms on social media are offering, and that's been, you see governments like New Zealand's a great example, their leaders being online, not just in press conferences, but in person, via her personal platforms, being open and accessible to the people. I guess that's a great example for other Pacific leaders to also take into account.
And of course, there you're talking about New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern's Facebook Lives, where she was talking to people and spreading the information about the lockdown that New Zealand had last week in a really kind of approachable and casual way. So, Lisa, how would you like to see governments work better with media groups and individuals so that everyone is doing what they need to do? The media is getting the information out there. They're reporting on the news. They're holding the government accountable. But at the same time, the government is also monitoring and making sure that the information that goes out is true news and not fake news.
I think what Pacific media, what journos and newsrooms have been feeding back through the networks and to each other is that Pacific governments are actually doing a great amount of good stuff. So be prepared to just open up a bit more on top of the great work that you're already doing, and also use this as an opportunity to stop seeing, for those governments out there who are stuck in that mindset, I guess stop seeing the media as adversary, as, you know, a black and white contrast between the work that you do and the work of keeping the public informed, and recognize the partnership that does exist that is already rolling out in some communities when it comes to seeing the media being open to questions. And I think for newsrooms, for many of us in newsrooms, being able to respond in real time and to stop deferring questions that need to be answered urgently, that people are asking in community forum, via direct messages to newsrooms and et cetera. People are asking questions that they urgently want answered, and just, I think, for our governments to consider having a strong and urgent response timeframe instead of the usual, we'll get back to you. That's not working in this new world.
Yeah, and as we saw in Vanuatu last week, when the government said that media outlets can only publish stories about COVID-19 if they get official authorisation, but what actually they meant was social media and not all media, it is a real indication of how clear communication, especially at this time between the government and the media, both sides, is so very important. I know you released a statement on Facebook, and it's only been up for just a few minutes, but have you received any response from any governments to your statement yet?
Governments don't tend to respond directly to the Article 90 monitoring work that we do, but we know that they do take note of it. I think it's imperative that governments realise the partnership and the role that Pacific journalists are also playing in monitoring misinformation on Facebook, because they're after the same thing. Journalists and newsrooms are also facing huge challenges in reporting the story and plowing through the minefield that is social media and getting to the facts of the matter. So we are telling ourselves, as well as our communities, to stick to the facts by going with, you know, the WHO websites, the national government websites, and the ministries of health for their information, to keep rejecting and not sharing, not liking, not even commenting on the false news or the fake news, the bad information that's out there. But you have to recognize at the end of the day that media and governments are on the same side when it comes to battling misinformation, and that social media, for all its failings and its dangers, presents huge opportunities that people need to keep in mind and keep in focus and keep safe for information to get out there and for lives to be saved.
Yeah. Lisa, thank you so much for joining Pacific Beat and talking through your views. I really appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you. Stay safe.
You too. That was Lisa Williams-Lahari there. She's a journalist and coordinator of the Pacific Freedom Forum. And to check out their statement, you can go to Facebook. If you just go, seriously, the easiest thing to do is just go to the Facebook search engine, type in Pacific Freedom Forum, and you'll be able to see their full statement there.
In times of health emergencies, it's important to have accurate information. Always check the source of information you read, and don't share information on social media or WhatsApp unless you are sure it's from a trusted source. To find accurate, up-to-date information about the coronavirus, search for ABC Radio Australia, the World Health Organization, or your country's government, online or on Facebook. Being well informed will help protect you and your community from the coronavirus.
Neville Coop is the director of Nandraki Weather and joins us now for a weather update. Good morning, Neville.
Hi, Talia.
How's it looking out there today, Neville?
So we're starting to see a build-up of monsoonal clouds now across the western part of the Pacific. If you imagine a line from the eastern islands of PNG across Solomons, northern Vanuatu, then down to Fiji, that's the South Pacific Convergence Zone at the moment, and that's where we're going to see some weather development over the course of this week.
Mm. What preparations have you seen across the region as people prepare for this weather?
Not a whole lot, to be frank. I've not sort of been paying a lot of attention, but I don't imagine that anybody really has much time or energy or resources to divert to this, given the important and complex issues we face right now with COVID-19. So I do hope that somebody has an eye on the ball here, because we're not out of the cyclone season, and it is looking much more likely now that we're going to see a cyclone form in the Coral Sea by the weekend.
Mm. And we were talking yesterday about the severity. Any update of what we can expect if it forms?
Look, it's the computer forecasts have been very erratic in the behaviour of this system and intensity, but it is consistently now in every single forecast run that the models produce. So it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. Mm. And what happens after it forms is still a little bit uncertain. I wouldn't want to make any firm predictions, but probably more likely than not, it's going to drift from water south of the Solomons, where it's going to form, towards New Caledonia and Vanuatu. And they look like they're going to be the ones that will probably bear the brunt of this system.
Mm. So we're talking high winds, lots of rain.
But we're probably talking a Category 2 or 3. Mm. Could be stronger. I'm not saying it won't be, but that would be my expectation at this stage.
Yeah, we know the people in the Pacific are very resilient, but preparedness is always the key. So obviously it's a case of making sure everything is tied down and doing the best you can to look after yourself and your property.
Of course, that's right. And the other thing to keep in mind here is that Pacific Islanders are quite superstitious and you know, they look upon these sort of things as being beyond their control and outside of their realm, and they're very religious and faith-based society. So when you throw in a major pandemic and a big tropical cyclone, you can imagine that the communities are going to start wondering, you know, what is the world doing to them? So there will be a lot of stress, a lot of concern. People don't always think straight in any sort of situation, so yeah. It really requires strong leadership. So hopefully somebody out there is getting ready for something like this to occur.
Yeah, absolutely. Neville, thank you so much for the update this morning.
You're welcome.
Thank you. That was Neville Coop there, the director of Nandraki Weather. And for weather updates at any time, you can always visit their Facebook page. You'll find them at Nandraki Weather. Time now to find out the stories making news, and Jordan Fennell joins me. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Talia.
My screen's up very high and I can't see you, so I'm just going to bring it
down. We can make eye contact now. Hello.
Radio is such an isolating job. I was like, I want to see the person I'm talking to. Me aside. So, Jordan, yesterday, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison introduced a range of new welfare measures to help people who've lost work because of the coronavirus situation. And there are thousands and thousands of people who have lost their jobs. And then some good news for New Zealanders in Australia. They will be eligible to access these benefits. What more do we know?
Yeah, so Kiwis across Australia and New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern have both been calling on the Australian government for help for Kiwis in Australia. Jacinda Ardern has repeatedly called on Scott Morrison to do something. And last night, the Australian government came through with a new range of measures to help people who have lost their jobs. It's a part of a stimulus package that is going to be worth $130 billion Australian dollars. It is absolutely huge. And essentially what it's going to be is it's going to be a wage subsidy that has $1,500 a fortnight for employees, given to them every fortnight for the next 6 months to keep them afloat, which is excellent news. Mm-hmm. And so for Kiwis, it's for the New Zealanders who are on the 444 special class working visa in Australia. Mm-hmm. They are the ones who will be eligible to take up this wage subsidy, which is great news.
Yeah, absolutely. We heard last week from Alex Robinson, who was a Kiwi living in Australia, who, you know, got a call from his boss saying, we don't need you to come into work. And he was talking to Marla Damati about how concerned he was about, you know, supporting his family, sick partners, everything that was going on. I'm not sure if he's on one of these visas that would mean that he was eligible, but no doubt it is a relief for a lot of Kiwis who are on these visas who aren't in a position to go back to New Zealand, who want to stay in Australia because, you know, some New Zealand citizens have been here for decades.
Yeah, exactly.
Lost their job through no fault of their own. No doubt it's obviously a relief for them that they'll still be able to get access to some benefits while the world just figures itself out. But that is a huge amount, $130 billion Australian dollars.
Yeah. But like I said, although it's only for the Kiwis on that 444 special class working visa, for those who are unemployed, and there are a range of conditions around this wage subsidy as well. If you're a casual, for example, you have to have been a casual in that job for 1 year to be eligible to receive this. So there are a couple of things for if you're a New Zealander listening to look out for when you're looking into this.
Yeah. I feel like they're going to be hitting their search engines and their internet's hard. Wouldn't be surprised if that website crashes at some point today just due to the high demand of people trying to find out if they're eligible. Now, this is a story that makes me laugh and then makes me question if I'm a bad person, because an astrophysicist in Australia ended up in hospital with magnets in his nose while trying to invent a coronavirus device. So many questions, Jordan. What happened?
Yeah, I saw this story floating around Twitter yesterday and I just had the best laugh reading it. It's so interesting. There's an astrophysicist named Dr. Daniel Reardon who had been trying to make a necklace and a bracelet device that would sound an alarm if you put your hand near your face.
Oh my God, I need that so much.
Exactly. I touch my face all the time, even though everyone keeps telling me I shouldn't do it. I can't stop. So it sounds like an excellent device. So essentially he had been in self-isolation, and because he's an astrophysicist, he works with things like gravitational pulls, and that's what he studies. And so he thought, you know, I'm just going to invent this device. Why not? I'm a genius. I can do this.
Literal train of thought.
Yeah.
I'm going to invent it. I'm a genius. On we go.
But this particular device, you needed to build a circuit. And he admitted in this story that he had no real knowledge of how to build circuits and things like that. So he was trying to build a circuit that would detect a magnetic field between the bracelet and the necklace. But while he was doing this, he got a bit bored and he was playing with the magnets. So he clipped the magnets to his earlobes to look like an earring. Normal fun things to do. But then he clipped the magnets to the inside of his nostrils. And because the strength of the magnets, I can see that you're crying. The strength of the magnets was so strong, they were clipped on the inside of his nostrils and he couldn't unclip them. They were lodged there, they were stuck there, and it was beginning to hurt as he tried to pull them apart. He searched on Google, tried to figure out how to get rid of it, couldn't get those magnets unstuck. Meanwhile, his wife, who is a doctor, he said, was laughing at him the entire time.
That makes me feel better.
And then finally decided to take him to the doctors, but not for help, just to get her colleagues to laugh at him. And then finally, the doctors at the hospital, they sprayed anesthetic on his nose and manually removed these magnets.
Do you know what I love about this story is, like, you can never, ever get mad at your kid ever for sticking something up their nose or up their ears, because this is an astrophysicist. He's a literal doctor.
Yes.
Got his PhD, studied for a really long time, and still was like, I'm bored. Let's stick it up my nose.
But you know what? I really want him to continue. Maybe not sticking magnets in his nose. Not sticking magnets in his nose. But I feel like this bracelet and necklace device definitely could be helpful.
Oh. I said that as I looked down and my hand was on my chin. And I don't even know why I put it there.
I just touched my chin as well.
Yeah. So Dr. Daniel Reardon, don't let that little magnet up your nose set back, like push you back. People like me and Jordan still need this device. Maybe just if you're still working on it, just keep it away from, you know.
He is the hero we need right now.
Openings in your face. That was very entertaining. I love that, you know, that story then got out in news. So not only did his partner take him to the hospital to embarrass him to his colleagues, now it just feels like he's been embarrassed all around the world. But a much needed laugh in these crazy, crazy times. Finally, Jordan, some drama in the art world. I feel like we need to play the Mission Impossible theme. Because a Vincent van Gogh painting has been stolen from a Dutch museum. What happened?
That's right. Police in Amsterdam have confirmed that a painting by the Dutch master Vincent van Gogh has been stolen in a smash-and-grab raid on a museum there. It was the Singer Laren Museum, and that's been closed for quite a few days because of the coronavirus.
It has too. The perfect time to commit a crime.
Exactly. All those criminals out there, don't take our word for it, but you know. But the museum director, now probably not going to pronounce this correctly, Evert van Os, says the stolen painting is called The Parsonage Garden at the Nieuwenen in Spring, dated from 1884. And this museum director actually got onto YouTube Live and made a broadcast about this painting being stolen. Oh. And he said, quote, "I'm really pissed off."
Do they know how they did it?
They don't know yet. The thieves have so far gotten away. They haven't been caught. But fun fact, that painting was stolen on Vincent van Gogh's birthday. So, ooh, the mystery deepens. What's going on here? Is it happy birthday, Vincent?
Did I find the theme?
Yes. And this was the theme song they were playing as they stole this painting.
This actually sounds jazzier than I want a heist
really
to
does.
Be.
Just doing some, like, jazz hands as you steal the painting.
This is why I could never be an art criminal. I would immediately be like, oh, it's her.
Yes.
She's just dancing to her own song in her head, doing an interpretive dance. It's very obvious
yes,
it's her.
It's normal.
Oh, fun times. Wow.
So we will keep everyone updated on that. We'll see if those thieves are caught.
Painting worth over 10 million Australian dollars. No doubt that they definitely want that painting back.
Oh, yes.
Jordan, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
No worries.
That was Jordan Fennell there with just some of the stories making news today.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. Shortly, we're going to find out about some artefacts that have been found in Papua New Guinea that date back thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago that unhold a whole lot of secrets. You'll hear about that very shortly. But first, a little bit of music. No, it's not the Mission Impossible theme. This is Tiggs the Author. The song is Run. Like the people who stole the painting. Brilliant.
I ran away from fighting, but they made me stronger. You can call me pussy. Pussy is power. Every time I let loose, I get this situation. I'm sorry, Miss Officer. Don't take me to the station. Always tucked up in the middle. Put my head inside a pillow. Till I'm feeling like bum, 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 bum. Jimmy Wow, head up in the clouds. Nothing in this life is ever bringing me down. She said, Don't you ever
run from my love. But you still run.
Run, 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 run,
one. Cause I be the one that walks on stage and makes them say. I be the one that's traveling the world, it's no vacay. I'm so unique, don't you see? Ocean deep, flow so sweet, and it's edible, I'm so incredible, incredible.
Indeed. That was Tiggs, the author, with Run.
Maintaining a safe distance between yourself and others is very important to slow the spread of coronavirus. When saying hello and goodbye to people you meet, it's important not to shake hands, hug, or kiss. A safer way to greet people is to simply wave and smile without touching. If you are interacting with someone who is coughing or sneezing, you should avoid physical contact entirely and stay 1.5 meters away from them. This will reduce the chance of spreading the virus.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. Australian archaeologist Ben Shaw has spent years in Papua New Guinea looking for signs of ancient life. Back in 2015, he was told about old weapons and tools that were buried in the Highlands village of Wyam. And so he started digging. What he discovered were artefacts that dated back over 5,000 years to the Neolithic period. Now, after years of studying these artefacts, Ben Shaw and his team have released new research that shows for the first time how the people of PNG lived thousands of years ago. Our reporter Jordan Fennell spoke with Ben Shaw about what his research has found.
In 2015, we'd spent a few months up there, Judith Field, my colleague at UNSW, and a few volunteers. And I'd covered kilometres of territory across a few different valley systems looking for archaeological sites of all different types, rock shelters, caves, open areas. And the purpose for that is we wanted to tell the story of where people were living on different parts of the landscape at different points in time, to tell one sort of overarching narrative. And what kept popping up in all these villages that we're visiting and talking with local communities were all these really intriguing artifacts. Some of them are stone axes, but pestles and mortars, club heads, and these really sort of enigmatic stone carvings of human and bird faces that we'd seen on the surface but we'd never found in the ground. So when myself and Judith Field went back in 2016 just for a quick follow-up trip before a long excavation season, this community from Wyam came across the mountain and said, hey, look, we've found a whole bunch of these artifacts in our village. Would you like to come and have a look? And I said, well, absolutely. I'd be delighted to. And, you know, thank you for coming across. Where's your village? And they said, it's on the other side of that mountain. And I looked up and I thought, okay, well, let's give this a go. So over the next few days, we organised people to come with me, to guide me across the mountain, people from the village. And I'd spent about 3 days across there, but I'd visited a few different villages along the way. And when we got to Wyam, lo and behold, there was this huge stash of artefacts under the houses that were these amazing artefacts that we'd never found before in the ground, ever in any archaeological site in New Guinea. And they'd found them all in the one place, or all in the sort of broad village area. So because I had limited time, I knew this was going to be a very important place, but I needed to really find a place that we could target if we were going to come back and excavate properly with the community. And so I looked around on the hilltop and found one place that I might dig. Had time to put in one quick hole with the spade before it got dark. And that's when I just got lucky. Halfway through the hole was the bottom of this beautifully carved stone pestle. And even luckier, on the end of it was a piece of charcoal that was stuck to it. So from that charcoal, being our time machine of sorts, we could radiocarbon date that. And when we got back to lab, that was 4,500 years old. So that was truly exciting. And of course, after that trip, we went back to the other side of the mountain and arranged to come back up later in the year to do a proper investigation.
That's a very exciting find, especially getting lucky like that to have just sort of dug a hole and found this 4,000-year-old artifact. Over the course of your excavations at that site, what were some of the artifacts that you did come across?
Well, we found a wide range of what we call formal artifacts, ones that have been deliberately made and shaped. And what was exciting was that there was the range but also the quantity all in one location. And so we found part of a stone carving, which was looks like it's either a human or an animal face. It's got the brow ridge and part of the eye. We found on top of the one that I'd found in that preliminary testing hole, found another end of a pestle. We found several stone axes of different shapes and sizes, and all of the stone debitage or reduction, showing the production process all the way from people picking up that piece of raw stone all the way through to the finished product, demonstrating that they'd made those stone tools on site. We found a stone that has a lot of iron minerals in it that people use to strike and make a spark to light fires, and a volcanic stone that had these unique sort of grooves in it, and on those grooves were ochre, brown red ochre, which it turns out was probably used for pulling organic fibers through, and people in that particular area and historically would have used the stone to make film string bags.
What is significant about that? I was reading in some of the research that because you'd only found surface artifacts, you hadn't been able to really see what life was like for people in PNG all those thousands of years ago. What are the significant findings that it reveals about people back then?
4,000 to 5,000 years ago, you start to getting more organisation in the garden systems. They're becoming larger and more complex. And they're starting to resemble a garden system, for example, that you might see in New Guinea today. So that sort of hints at population pressure on these wetland areas where they're gardening, so they have to become more organised. Perhaps more territorial boundaries are being enforced. So they're having to use more space, more effectively, for more productivity to cope with a larger population. That's sort of the hypothesis. What we're missing is how people were responding to that change in the way they live. Cook Swamp being a garden, we don't have that evidence. But Wyam, which is located in the next valley, this Wyam archaeological site, dates to the same period, 4,000 to 5,000 years ago, is this intensification of agriculture. And what we're seeing there for the first time, all of these unique artifacts, many of which have never been found in the ground and dated before, all occurring within the same location, demonstrating to us that they're being used and beginning this exponential, it seems, increase in technological change.
I was wondering, what did the villagers in Wyam feel about it? Were they excited that this was happening? Did they understand how important and significant it was?
The exciting thing was that they did. It's why they approached us in the first place, our team. And when initially myself and then all of us went across the mountain to work with them, they were really an integral part of that discovery process. And normally an archaeological excavation is quite tedious. It's sort of rinse and repeat. And the reason for that is because you want to be as thorough as possible in recording whatever's coming out of the ground so you have the context you need to interpret it. Within the 2 weeks that we excavated this site, it was fun the entire time because the community were completely buzzing. We were buzzing. Our team, there was stuff coming out of the ground all the time. Just hugely exciting that we were trying to figure out how it fit into the big picture. They were engaged all the way through, and even still, they're a very key part of that process of how we look at the archaeology going forward.
And can I ask what you were most excited about finding? Which artifact, I guess, was most significant to you?
The one that really stood out was that broken piece of stone carving, because in the first instance, when it was coming out of the ground, it was upside down, so we didn't know that it was a carving until that very last moment, which we fortunately caught on camera. We turned it round and saw the structure of the carving.
And what are the next steps moving forward with your research?
The finds that we've got, there's more time that needs to be spent in the lab to analyse great detail what these artefacts are, where they come from, their form, how they might have been used. And in terms of the problem that we're facing in New Guinea with this Neolithic, these societal changes that come after agriculture or with developments in agriculture, the problem is now is how do you actually define what agriculture looks like in different parts of the world?
That was archaeologist Ben Shaw speaking there to reporter Jordan Fennell. Didn't his life just sound like he was a real-life Indiana Jones, just going to dig sites and finding things? Not so much of the going into the lab and doing reports and research. That's not very Indiana Jonesy, but the other bit definitely was. If you want to see photos of these artefacts that were dug up in Wyom, then head on over to the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page. They're not there yet, but they will be. So while you wait for us to upload the photos, you can have a look at some of this other stories we've posted up there as well.
Time you wasim an blong you can look out in you yet na family blong you long coronavirus. Wasim an one time clean water na soap mark long 20 seconds, sample time long one day. Wasim an past time long you all in best blong you, time you like all in kai or time you like kai. Wasim an behind lo you use in toilet, then lo you go around long all public place, also market, na time you all in online who said he can get sick. Time you wash a man blong you can help him look out him you yet na family blong you, he stop safe.
Good advice there about washing your hands, delivered there in Tokpisin by Hilda Wayne. Now, the PNG Hunters Rugby League team are still in quarantine in Port Moresby following their return from Brisbane after what's turned out to be their first and last match of their 2020 Queensland Cup season. But no one knows when the players will take to the field again or how it will be financed, as the Hunters depend heavily on sponsorship for their income. Richard Ewart's been looking into what impact the shutdown of the competition might have on the Hunters community. It all started so well, but it now looks like some hard decisions will need to be made.
It was two tries in 3 minutes for the Hunters when Terry Wappy crossed for his second. The scores were locked at 30-all after Terry Wappy scored his third try of the second half with 7 minutes left on the clock. A late hit on the kicker gave PNG this penalty from right in front. Asay Boas making no mistake, putting the Hunters in the lead.
It was a comeback for the ages for the PNG Hunters in the opening match of a new Queensland Cup season, winning the game against South Slogan Magpies 32-30 after being 36 down. So a great start for a new-look team under a new coach in Matt Church, but now the whole season has been abandoned in the face of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Didn't think it was going to get to this point. They tried to make a decision that's in the benefit for everyone's health and safety. So you have to commend the Kirol for going down that pathway. In terms of contingency plans, I guess working through with the board in discussions about how we map our path forward for the rest of 2020. So it's probably a little bit too early to say what our plan is yet. There'll be ongoing discussions over the next few days and in the coming weeks, I'd say, to try and get something up and moving towards the 2021 season.
As the only full-time team in the Queensland Cup, the impact on the club will be substantial, and Matt Church says talks with sponsors are ongoing.
Hopefully in the coming days we can all sit down as a collective with the board and talk to our partners and sponsors about what kind of value we can obviously add for their investments going forward, whether that's this year or add experiences for 2021.
Former Hunters coach and now head of high performance for the PNG RFL, Michael Marham, says for some of the Hunters players, rugby league is the only way they can earn.
Impact the players' lives, you know, the families, and especially in some of those boys that come off settlement and, you know, they got nothing else to do apart from playing rugby league and earning a bit more coin for themselves and the families.
However, as coach of the Kumuls, the PNG national team, Marham is hopeful there will be some action later in the year that will give players a chance to get back into shape ahead of any rescheduled international matches.
Travel bans, restrictions, everything else will come into play, but we want to see these boys playing some sort of football for at least 3 months before we consider them for selections if they are to make the national team if there are games this year.
But from the outset, the Hunters have been less of a team and more of a rugby league family. And Matt Church says health and well-being must come first.
Our immediate plans are just to make sure that everyone within the Hunters stays safe. Their health and well-being is paramount to not only myself but to the rest of the club. So looking at making sure that they're all doing well and being supportive. Travelling back into PNG, our guys are still in their 14-day isolation, which will end this Wednesday coming up on the 1st of April. So hopefully the travel bans in PNG lift as well so that we can get them home to see some family, to put everyone else's mind at ease that they're there, and it's good for their welfare for them to be around family and friends. That's definitely our immediate focus, the welfare and well-being of, you know, not just our players and staff and admin, but just those are people that are in our Hunters community.
Michael Marham only just made it home before the PNG borders closed, and now he's involved in working with teachers to educate children and young people on good hygiene and how to protect themselves from COVID-19.
I've been around the country, and then luckily I got back into my own province just before we had the state of emergency up here, the 14-day lockdown. So spending time at home with the family and also making sure, just, you know, in our region, there's the school's competition that was supposed to kick off next month. Now at this stage, we're just going around talking to teachers, making sure we're preparing well for those competitions if they go ahead. But depending on the virus, you know, we haven't got cases up here yet. But, you know, if it's PNG, you know, there's a lot of people walking around doing nothing, so, you know, hanging around big groups. But this week, next week, we'll just be engaged with making awareness about the virus, you know, how we can talk to the young kids and also the families in the areas that we come from, and, you know, try to provide this assistance. We're just going around talking to those people close by here.
Meanwhile, the new Fijian team, the Silktails, who kicked off their debut season in New South Wales with a win, still don't know if their competition, the Ron Massey Cup, might yet restart once the COVID-19 emergency is over in Fiji and Australia. While other competitions in New South Wales have been abandoned, the Ron Massey Cup has not been scrapped as yet, possibly because of the small number of teams involved, which might make it more viable to continue later in the year. In the meantime, it's just more frustration for the Silktails chairman, Petro Sivnisiva, who battled for 6 years to get the club off the ground, and the pride in his voice was obvious on the eve of their historic first match.
It's extremely exciting, and, you know, from our past conversations over many years, 6 years to be precise, it is wonderful now that we're at this moment. There's been really good interest, and it's certainly a topic of conversation, especially in Lotoka, where the team is based. So we're really looking forward to our first game and giving these players an opportunity to, as I've always stated, showcase their talent up against an Australian competition.
Meanwhile, in the midst of the current crisis and the disappointment of losing a whole Queensland Cup season, Hunters coach Matt Church has conjured up a little humour in adversity and managed to put a positive spin on the whole situation.
The final score, PNG 32, South 30 in an Intrust Super Cup thriller.
Still a bit raw, still, I guess, personally in a little bit of shock that we're only going to see one game for 2020. Thankfully, we won that game, so we can probably count that as an undefeated season.
But actually, I thought that was really funny. Looking at it as an undefeated season is definitely how you make lemonade out of lemons. And, you know, no one's going to argue. You play one game and it's your only game of 2020. It's definitely an undefeated season. PNG Hunters coach Matt Church there talking to Richard Hewitt in what is no doubt a very disappointing time for a rugby league mad nation like Papua New Guinea to lose their number one team's whole season. But I'm sure if they come back in 2021, they will have the support of the nation very firmly behind them.
Coronavirus is all over the news, so here's some simple information about the virus and how to protect yourself and your family. Coronavirus, also called COVID-19, is an infectious disease similar to the flu. Most people who get it recover after mild symptoms such as sore throat and a cough. But it can be more serious for older people and those who are already unwell. Some people have died from the illness. There is no vaccine for coronavirus, but there are some things you can do to protect yourself. Regularly wash your hands with soap for at least 20 seconds. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid crowded places. Don't touch your eyes, nose, or mouth. If you get sick with mild symptoms, stay at home. Cough or sneeze into your elbow or a tissue. If you develop a fever or difficulty breathing, call your local hospital or health centre for advice.
Good advice. They say when it comes to health messaging that repetition, repetition, repetition is the key. So you'll be hearing those promos a lot here on Pacific Beat and across ABC Radio Australia. That is all for Pacific Beat for this morning. But Richard Ewart will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of the show. So keep listening to ABC Radio Australia and make sure you also follow and like the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page so you can ensure that you'll get the latest news and developments from around the region. And we also post the stories that we did in the morning online as well. Remember to be kind, stay home, save lives, look after yourself and your family. I'll catch you tomorrow.